Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. If you're interested, the ads are still running and the loans are still out there. Mortgage loans for one and all, the salesmen practically say. No money down, no matter what your credit history, no matter what your income, no documentation required, just come on down. And waves of cash-strapped Americans have, to get what the headlines now scream, are subprime mortgage loans. When home prices were soaring, the subprime loan business was a giant joyride. Wall Street rushed in. Now, home prices are falling. The subprime circus tent is crashing down, and it threatens to bring the U.S. housing market, the stock market, and maybe the economy down with it. Up next on Point, easy money coming down hard and fears of a subprime panic. For the basics and the latest on the subprime collapse, we begin with James R. Haggerty. He covers housing and the mortgage business for the Wall Street Journal and joins us from Pittsburgh. James Haggerty, thanks very much for being here.
Hi there, Tom.
So give us the latest, the evidence in this week of what's gone wrong with this big wing of mortgage lending.
Well, we're seeing the after effects of the slowdown in housing. Now people are finding it hard to keep up on their mortgage payments, and more people are going to lose their homes. We do have to keep it in perspective. I think most Americans are easily keeping up on their mortgage payments, but there's going to be a significant number who will be in trouble.
Delinquency rates at record levels, lots of foreclosures out there. Remind us of the basics here, if you would, Jim. And we all hear the ads, you know, it doesn't matter what your income is, no documentation required, come on down. What was the subprime mortgage lending business?
Well, it's loans for people who have weak credit histories or who have a lot of debt in relation to their income. And it is a legitimate business. It's just that things got a bit out of hand. Standards were lowered too far. People were given too much money without enough thought given to their ability to repay. And it was easier to make this work when house prices were rising very quickly, because if you fell behind on your loan, you could probably sell your house quite easily, or you could refinance into another loan with easier terms. Now that game has kind of come to a stop, and so we're going through this rough transition.
Jim Haggerty, help us understand this. Maybe 6 months or a year ago, we did a show looking at all the adjustable rate mortgages out there and the risks they might pose for homeowners if and when interest rates went higher, and of course they have. But we didn't anticipate at that time what a structural problem, what a big economic issue this might be. Why is mortgage lending causing such a ruckus on Wall Street and making people think about the whole economy as it shakes?
Well, I think it's because this is going to hurt the housing market. It's going to delay the recovery in the housing market. And so that has people worried about how much is that going to hurt the overall economy. Housing is obviously a big part of the economy. It's a big part of consumer confidence and consumer spending. So this has increased the risk of recession. Now, most economists are still saying we'll probably avoid a recession this year, but there is a little bit of a higher risk, and the markets are reacting to that fear.
Talk about these dominoes of the subprime mortgage lending companies that have been falling and how that hits Wall Street and the big investment bankers, hedge funds, even mutual funds there.
Well, many of them are holding securities that are backed by home mortgages, and so there are going to be losses on some of those securities. But, of course, a lot of traders have positioned themselves to profit from this. They have been buying securities, betting against the housing market, and so some of them are making a lot of money, some of them are losing money. We won't know for a few months, really, who's up and who's down.
Now, just this week, we saw some big losses on Wall Street, some recovery of that, but some pretty head-snapping, neck-snapping losses after news came out about delinquency rates here. What was that, Jim?
Well, that was probably a bit of an overreaction, because the latest news on delinquencies really wasn't that surprising. We've known for months that they've been going up, and that was just a confirmation of what people should have known. But I guess there's just a kind of air of nervousness right now because so many subprime lenders have gone out of business and people are reacting to bad news rather than good news at the moment.
And is it over? Do we have a lot more to come? What's it look like?
I don't think it's over because we're going to have the effects on the housing market for at least months to come, if not years to come. So this issue will be with us for a while. We don't know how serious it's going to become. It's definitely a problem. We don't know if it's really a crisis yet.
There's some talk of Congress getting involved here. What's afoot there?
Well, Congress is talking about various things that could be done. One idea that's been advanced is that the FHA, which is part of the Housing and Urban Development Department,
Federal Housing Authority, yeah,
could offer mortgage products that would help people in trouble refinance into a better loan.
So sort of bail them out of the mortgage.
More money for counseling borrowers.
Mm. But we're talking huge money here, done one loan at a time, and some crazy vocabulary around these liar's loans. What's that?
Well, those are the loans where you don't have to document fully your income or your assets. You don't have to necessarily pull out a lot of old wage stubs or income tax forms. And they were used partly for a legitimate reason. Some people have a hard time documenting their income if they're self-employed. But they were also used just as a convenience to make it faster for people to get loans. And that was a pretty sloppy practice because they can encourage people to exaggerate, and they can easily be used to get people into homes that they really couldn't afford.
Maybe this is where the scandal tinge comes in, when you draw the line all the way from a loan made like that, no documentation, a liar's loan, a kind of open invitation to write down anything you like about what your income might be, is or isn't. You tie it all the way back to Wall Street. Is this what our big investment banks, even mutual funds, should be putting their money into? Was this a kind of a backdoor way to get loan shark returns on loans really not adequately backed up?
Yes, I think in a way. I think the investors, Wall Street, and the lenders were all kind of lulled into lowering their standards because it was so easy to make money during the housing boom. And some loan products that started out as legitimate products for a small group of borrowers started to be used by a larger and larger group of borrowers. And people kind of lost sight of some of the fundamentals of careful lending. This is something that happens periodically in the mortgage industry. There's a big boom, and then there's a purge of the sloppy practices and the weaker lenders.
But the purge could be painful on many fronts this time, we read, not least from you. James Haggerty at the Wall Street Journal, thanks very much for getting us started here.
Thank you.
I want to turn now to Ivy Zelman. She's a managing director and housing analyst at Credit Suisse in New York. Ivy Zelman, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
Should say right off the bat, I think Credit Suisse put a lot of money into companies doing just this kind of business, a billion plus, if I'm not wrong.
Actually, my area would not be experts. My expertise wouldn't be on what Credit Suisse does, but you know, those numbers sound about right.
So a lot of big investment banks and eyes wide open players getting in here to subprime mortgages. We'll talk about that. But first, what about the impact on the housing market here? James Haggerty is saying it could delay a recovery. What about the further downside possibility here as subprime rocks the whole lending industry?
Well, I certainly am concerned about it. We already have, unfortunately, had a lot of weakness in housing, and there's, you know, a considerable amount of existing inventory as well as new inventory on the market, and we've seen incentives with a very good time for a buyer to be out there because there's, we call it incentives are king right now, and it's been a very weak market. So on now, adding on top of that the credit tightening and fallout of the subprime borrower's ability to buy, I think you can look for another tranche down, unfortunately.
Like how much? How much might sales prices drop?
Well, you know, Tom, we've been saying, we just published a report that quantified the impact because we don't believe that, unfortunately, this is just a subprime issue. We think this will affect the entire housing food chain by credit tightening throughout, and therefore we're looking for about a 20% negative impact to incremental demand.
Do you mean on home prices or on home sales?
That would be on the unit front, and mm-hmm. In terms of actual prices, we've been saying that from the peak of the market, we're thinking that nationally home prices will decline, incorporating the impact from credit tightening, about 20%.
How much further is that from now, Ivy? Yeah,
that's about another 6 to 8%.
So that would really hurt. What about the foreclosure front? Have we seen the worst of that?
Unfortunately, I don't think so. You know, the foreclosure data is still on a relative basis. You know, nationally, you're looking at about 1% of households have been foreclosed. With the fallout just in the last 30 days of what's going on in the subprime market, I think that number is going to go up. You know, some markets like Colorado and Texas and Ohio, the numbers are much higher than 1% of households. I think Colorado is 2.7% of households. So some would say this is not a, you know, a complete Armageddon crisis, but I think that you certainly expect those numbers will rise. And what happens, unfortunately, assuming those houses don't get sold at auction when they are going to be foreclosed, you could be adding more units to inventory.
Ivy, was this crazy? Is this a scandal? Was this good business gone bad?
You know, I think that when you look back over the last several years, you have to realize that, you know, home price acceleration really drove a lot of people into the housing market that were investors, speculating, flippers. The yield curve or interest rates got so low, making it so easy to buy with very little money down. And the mortgage originators and the mortgage brokers, everybody jumped on board. And, you know, I guess, you know, unfortunately, greed has a lot to do with this. And it you know, we're paying, you know, it's payback is tough.
Ivy Zelman, thanks for joining us. We're talking this hour about the subprime mortgage scare, rocking home prices, markets, and maybe soon, we hope not, but maybe the whole economy, asking whether it's not just a scare, but maybe a scandal. I'm joined now from New York by Josh Rosner, Managing Director at Graham Fisher & Company, an independent investment research firm. He's an expert on mortgage securities. Josh Rosner, thanks very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom.
And from New Haven, Connecticut, we're joined by Robert Schiller, professor of economics at Yale University, widely known, celebrated for his timely predictions on the bursting of the tech stock bubble in 2000 and for his cutting-edge analysis on the real estate market. He's author of Irrational Exuberance. You've heard of that, co-founder of Macro Markets. Robert Schiller, great to have you with us again. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
Josh Rosner, take us in here first. What are the dimensions of this? We're just little guys down at the end of the food chain, but how big a rock in the pond is this subprime mortgage problem?
Well, I think we need to actually separate the question into almost two parts. There's the real economy and there's the market economy. I think in the real economy, the risks, at least, are very large. I think it's more than possible. I think it's highly likely that it will actually move higher into the food chain. And you can look at that in any number of ways. But
when you say the real economy, then what do you mean with that division?
I'm talking about the housing market.
Yep.
That at the end of the day, if you end up seeing foreclosures rise and therefore inventories build further, mm-hmm. the buyer doesn't really care whether the prior seller had financed his purchase with a subprime mortgage.
Right.
And so you have the likelihood that that will actually at least start pressuring home prices.
Okay. Which have already felt pressure, which have already come down significantly in many areas.
Absolutely. I do think that there is this, you know, question of is it greed or was this, you know, loan sharking? You know, the seeds of this have been sown. I'd written a piece called A Home Without Equity is a Rental with Debt. It was a 30-page report back in the summer of 2001, really going through how the structural changes in the housing and housing finance markets had significantly changed what we thought of housing historically. Historically, you put 20% down.
Right.
For the most part, you took out a 30-year mortgage, and you made a monthly payment. And it was essentially considered a forced savings plan.
Right.
Money in was trapped.
Mm-hmm.
So besides the fact that we've reduced down payment requirements, that we've focused on targeting low-income borrowers, and I don't say that in a predatory way. I say that in a expansion of credit, democratization of credit.
That's an interpretation. We'll test it, but we hear it. Yep.
Okay. Reduction in private mortgage insurance requirements, the use of technology to automated underwrite these loans and appraise them. We've gone through such massive changes that, frankly, this actually is less a typical housing cycle than it has become a typical credit cycle.
And in that sense, in a whole new world, Robert Schiller, that takes us close to your universe. first just speak to the scale of what we've got sitting in front of us here. Lots of Americans trying to sort of catch up with this train and figure out how big a deal it is that we've got this trouble in this sector of the mortgage lending industry, subprime. How big a deal is it?
Well, I think the trouble in the mortgage industry is a symptom of a rapidly changing housing market. Home prices have been rising since the 1990s. We've been in the biggest boom in home prices that this country has ever seen, and it's showing signs possibly of turning. Now, the futures market at the CME for home prices is predicting declines, and that is the big event because that affects everyone who owns a home. Now, what we're looking at is the default rates on subprime loans, which are the most vulnerable, and we're seeing. On subprime ARMs, now it's up to 14.4% of them are in default.
Because these were homeowners who could barely afford the home in the first place, and now that's coming home to roost.
Well, yeah, a lot of mortgage lenders would take a borrower who has a poor credit history and a poor chance of repaying and give that person an adjustable rate mortgage, which can be predicted, a few years ago when interest rates were so low, can be predicted to have rising payments. And that's a recipe for disaster, and it has resulted for those borrowers in disaster. One in seven of them is already defaulting, and the story is not over yet.
So as this pig goes through the python, as the economy tries to digest this, how big are the risks attached to it?
Well, I think this is a very important story for our time, and a story that will evolve over a number of years. I think there is substantial risk of a dislocation in our economy, a recession or something like that. But I think also for individuals, there is a risk of, losing your home. What could be more wrenching a crisis for a family than to be put out on the street? Well, I may be being a little dramatic about that, but it's going to create a lot of tension and upset people.
Yeah, people get upset in a hurry on the street. Joshua Rosner, explain for us why this was attractive to investors. Robert Shiller says, well, look, you could see what was going to happen. They could barely afford it at the beginning. You could see that the payments were going to have to go up. At the same time, I'm reading here the average loan in 2000 to a subprime lender made was for 48% of the value of the house. By last year, that figure was 82%, so they're loaning a huge amount against the house. They can see that people are not going to be able to make the payments. Why was this ever seen as good business? How did it work? How did people make big returns on this? Smart people, hedge funds and all that, were jumping in here. Why?
Well, I think you also have to remember, though, and it speaks to a question that you had asked earlier in the show, which is, you'd use the word loan sharking. Mm. And I think when you're talking about subprime borrowers and you look at the higher than prime interest rates that they pay, some of those borrowers actually are marginally below prime credits and some of them are significantly below prime credits.
But they don't seem to pay more at the beginning. What you hear on the radio is 1%, 2%,
Well, that's right. And that you're talking about really the move to interest only and negative amortization products, which, there's a issue with the way that we've got interest deductibility that actually a lot of borrowers use the interest deductibility to actually justify the purchase of a house. And if you think that you're going to be in a house for 3 years, 5 years, 7 years, or that interest rates will stay low and you'll be able to refinance, there was a lot of reason for a lot of people to fool themselves, not think it through rationally, but fool themselves into believing that they'd be able to handle it.
Well, and we get why the homeowners would do that, but how did this turn into big returns for hedge funds, investment bankers, Goldman Sachs, and all these guys who are supposed to know what they're doing? They were making big returns for a while. How?
Well, essentially, you would take the mortgages, you'd pool 1,000 mortgages together into a mortgage-backed security. And then you would slice that, and you'd have the part that would actually receive interest and the part that would receive the, in one way of thinking about it, the part that would take the first interest payment and the part that would actually get what was left over. And so you risk-based priced these assets, and you slice them and you dice them. And investors were able to think that they were able to buy the appropriate risk level for their needed returns.
And if they got the riskier piece of this, they got a very high return on that. Robert Shiller, is this another period of irrational exuberance? Did it go again to the very heart of Wall Street, the hedge funds, and all the rest? Or was there some rationale in here that I'm missing today?
You ask it, Tom, Josh, a very good question. Why did businesses do that? Why do they think it was good business to buy these mortgages or to issue these mortgages? Because they stand to lose. The business people stand to lose if they default.
And they're losing right now.
But this pattern has been characteristic of business cycles from time immemorial. And you have to look at what's going on within an organization that lends money or that buys securitized mortgages.
Mm.
And it's a story of individual careers, of individual people making moral decisions at a time of great uncertainty. What often happens, different people reach different conclusions, and within an organization they do. But there's an uncertainty about the future, fuzziness about the future, and there's an impulse for many people who are within businesses to think, this is an opportunity, this is a booming market, maybe everything will come out okay. Hey, I'm going to assume the best, because I'm not going to just stay on the sidelines when something exciting is going on. I'm going to make these loans, or I'm going to buy these securitized mortgages, full knowing that there's a chance of this bad outcome. But they tell themselves a story. This is human psychology.
Yeah.
They tell themselves the good story, and they say, I'm going to do this, and I won't be alone, incidentally. I won't be singled out and walked off in handcuffs.
That may be right. It's a generous story, and it may be right, but I'm looking here, 35% of all mortgage securities issued last year in the subprime category, up from 13% just 3 years earlier. Now, and we've heard it in this hour, talk of a bailout here.
Yes.
You can't help wondering if this is kind of an heir to the SNL scandal, if there's a kind of playing of the system here, Robert Shiller.
It is. I think that this is a regulatory lapse. We have learned in this country that financial markets need regulation because the phenomenon that I just described produces all sorts of crazy things. So we have the Securities and Exchange Commission that regulates our financial markets, but it does not have authority over mortgage origination. And in fact, there is no federal authority that supervises all mortgage originators. We've had to have guidances issued by a consortium of government agencies that even then do not cover all of mortgage origination. When you don't have regulators, it makes it hard for the more ethical, more principled people to even operate in the business because you've got to compete with the other people whose fuzzy morals are bringing the business down.
It seems like about 5 minutes since WorldCom and Enron, and here we are in another gigantic sector and this kind of concern again. Let me turn to my listeners. Steve is calling from Cambridge. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Yeah.
My comment is that a year and a half ago, The Economist magazine published a cover article saying that this was the biggest bubble, the housing bubble was the biggest bubble in history, and warned people to look out for the pain when the whole thing collapsed. And so your show is about the subprime markets, but after that we've got the Alt-A and the adjustable markets, and people are, frankly, really freaked out about those. And so I'd like to really name some names here about who is involved in this. And on my list, I've got Greenspan's Fed, who admits in their own writings that the housing market is a key channel of monetary policy transmission. So they knew what they were doing when they lowered interest rates to address the last dot-com bubble. There's also the National Association of Realtors that published books just 2 years ago with the titles Are You Missing the Real Estate Boom? Why Home Prices and Other Real Estate Investments Will Climb Through the End of the Decade and How to Profit from Them. Then you have the financial media, yourself excluded here, Tom, that was consistently misreporting the risks associated with this market. Excuse me. And finally, you've got Congress, who's just becoming concerned now after the horses left the barn. This is just one huge pump and dump scandal.
Pump and dump. Steve, you've got a tough list and a long one there. We will look at it. Thank you very much for calling. Josh Rosner, how about it? There's some serious finger pointing right there.
Yeah, and I think that the sentiment is probably pretty widespread. of the listeners' points.
And it doesn't go back that far. Bear Stearns saying, what, 2 weeks ago, that one of these big lenders, New Century, was A-OK, and then about six seconds later, it implodes.
But I think we actually need to go back and start really thinking about the emotional ties that we've all been raised to believe in home ownership, right? And what is home ownership? Home ownership is an integral part of the American dream for most people. And so we really need to start thinking about, you know, where the roots of this were sown. Is it really a blame story? Is there something more to it? Is home ownership actually having a large mortgage debt, having no equity in the home, and having the ability to continuously take out appreciated equity without putting anything more down? So I think the responsibility can be, you know, placed on pretty much everyone's shoulders. I think the listeners,
because people want to own homes, they have an emotional investment in their home, they may see it as a piggy bank. But has that been emotion, Robert Shiller, has that emotion been exploited here in a way from the heights of Wall Street?
Well, of course, the business world will exploit. Someone in the business world will exploit any emotion. The real thing that's happened is that we have seen home prices, they've doubled in the last nationwide since 2000. And people have gotten the idea, this is I've revealed in surveys I'm doing of homeowners, they have gotten the idea that home prices are going to keep going up at something like 7, 8, 10% a year. Some people think 20% a year. And that has changed our whole thinking about the world in unfortunate ways. One consequence is that the personal savings rate has become negative. People are thinking, hey, I'm getting rich. My house is worth $500,000 now, and in a few years it's going to be worth $1 million. Why should I bother to save? And that is infecting people's thinking, and it's distorting the economy. And that's the fundamental problem.
Well, I think, Josh? Can I
yes,
can
please.
I add something there?
Yeah.
I think that actually that's a good point from the perspective also that you have to remember that coming into the early 90s, the recession from the 80s economy, home ownership levels were stagnant. They were at 1981 levels. Since World War II, home ownership has hovered between 62 and 64% in this country. And there was a lot of concern. How are we going to, with affordability having become a problem at that point in time, how are we going to increase home ownership? And there was a massive push. And it wasn't really led by Wall Street, by the way. It was, in fact, led broadly. It was there was the largest private-public partnership ever created, and they came up with a national home ownership strategy whose mission was to increase home ownership rates to 70% by the end of the 90s. Well, in doing so, you're obviously also you're largely bringing in people who never would have had access to home ownership before. You've done so in a way where maybe they don't have to have down payments the way they would before. And by driving those people into home ownership, right, perhaps before all of them are ready or some of them are ready, you're also having the effect of driving this home price appreciation.
But people did not do that out of the goodness of their hearts. I mean, this was business at the end of the day.
Well, it's business at the end of the day, absolutely. And, you know, business also needs a willing participant in terms of the underlying buyer.
Right now from Nashville, Tennessee, Lisa, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I am one of those people that lost my home. I am livid. I moved from Connecticut, actually.
Yep.
I bought a home in a very nice area outside of Nashville, the suburbs.
Yep.
I was reeled in. I had just come out of a divorce, single parent, wanted my kids to have the nice house, good education, everything else.
Mm-hmm.
They gave me two mortgages. The first, they said, was an adjustable rate. I owned a home before. It was fixed. They said it would only just go up just a little bit, you know?
And were you buying over your head? Did you buy a mansion? What did you pay?
No, I bought a four-bedroom home. It was a beautiful home. It was an older home.
How much?
I bought it for $112,900.
$112,000. Okay.
Yeah, it was a good deal.
Yeah.
So I moved in there, and the first mortgage was $600. This was in 2002. The first mortgage was $616. The second mortgage was $196.
Okay, so you had $700 and some a month to pay. That was manageable. And what happened?
Yes. Well, it went up almost $500 where I couldn't afford it. I work in a hospital. I have a good job. I was definitely able to afford it. But it went up so high that I decided to get out of it. I, in turn, had some investor friends of mine that said, don't worry about it, Lisa. We'll take care of it. It got so high where they could not take care of it. And they just auctioned off the house last November. So now I have a foreclosure on my record, okay? It's not, it went in, it started with greed. It definitely started with greed.
But was it was your greed included there, Lisa? I mean, you know, it's terrible to get kicked out. We're sorry to hear that you have. But you went in eyes wide open, I presume. You saw this was like a teaser rate or a low early rate. You knew it could get bigger.
Right. Well, they said it would go up a little bit. I didn't do the research on how explosive it can get.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't do the research on it, and I think us, when as Americans, you know, we need to research a whole lot more of what's going on.
How much do you see as your fault, and how much the fault of a system that was sort of set up to reel in somebody like you?
Well, I think it was set up. First of all, we have to think of who set it up. Who set it up and why was it set up? Because my family, I do not think as an investment.
But the word we're hearing in part here today is they were trying to help out people like you, trying to help make you a homeowner.
No, what they tried to do was make money on my family and squeeze me out of the house. And that's what happened. I feel it's horrible that the government does not have this type of regulations to have this checked out before it begins.
Lisa,
it's a very bad thing.
We hear the story, and it's about as rough as it can get. We're sorry it happened that way, but let me get response from my guest, Robert Schiller. What do you say to this very real story from Lisa outside Nashville?
See, this is exactly the big story. I'm glad you had Lisa on, because this is the real social consequence. You know, it doesn't matter to most of us if we have a downturn in the stock market. We all live through it. But what Lisa went through was, I'm sure, very wrenching.
Mm.
And I think that she is probably right, that somebody in the lending business was not being upfront with her. Somebody didn't care about her. The problem is that we have a country where people assume that there are regulations, that the government is watching, and that somebody can't do that. But in this case, there was nobody watching. Now, this was a bad example of what sometimes happens in the mortgage industry. And I think it is important that we get on to this as a nation.
But should somebody be looking out for her? Or is this just the American way, you know, buyer beware, you're on your own, good luck, baby?
We have what's called the Consumer Product Safety Commission that investigates safety faults in consumer products. We don't have that for mortgage lending. That's what we need.
Josh Rostner, how do you interpret? How do you hear the story?
Yeah, I mean, I've got a couple of questions. First of all, what would the comparable rent have been? And perhaps if she didn't have significant equity to put down, she might have remained a renter if it was a comparable number.
So you're saying, Lisa, why did you become a homeowner? Why did you imagine that was for you?
Yeah,
okay.
And it is, obviously, it's quite tragic. And it is exactly the fallout. And I've had these concerns. And at the same time, there is this belief and this assumption that there necessarily was someone predatory. Now, you know, I should say for the record, I've never taken any money from as clients, banks, investment banks, trade associations. I've got no vested interest in taking the position I am. In fact, my only clients are institutional investors, okay, many of whom are losing money here.
Right.
But there are actually regulations on the books. The Federal Trade Commission Act protects against unfair, deceptive acts or practices. And each of the financial regulators actually has the responsibility to actually support that.
But Josh, you yourself are quoted in the New York Times saying this is far more dramatic than what led to Sarbanes-Oxley.
No question.
And you said both in terms of conflicts, I presume you mean conflicts of interest.
Absolutely.
And in terms of absolute economic impact. Are you backpedaling on that?
Not at all. And actually, you know, there's, I guess part of the difference between my perspective and Dr. Schiller's is I think that there's, frankly, a problem at the top of the food chain. Okay.
What is it?
Well, we talked about how loans get pooled into mortgage-backed securities.
Yep.
Mortgage-backed securities, the riskiest part of the mortgage-backed securities, in turn, often get pooled into something called a CDO, a collateralized debt obligation.
Okay.
Investors have very little information. There is very little transparency or disclosure about what is in that asset. And in fact, even our financial regulators don't have an understanding or access to the information that their institutions may be invested in.
What does it have to do with Lisa or with somebody's 401k?
It has everything to do with it because, first of all, you've got, I think if investors had a clearer understanding of what they might be holding and the size of the risks, a Lisa, who posed a risk to an investor and, frankly, a social risk to our society by being put in this horrible position where she ended up purchasing a home that she shouldn't have actually been given the loan for.
But Robert Shiller,
actually cut off the capital, if investors were unwilling to buy these products that are being put out there by investment banks, or didn't, or at least understood the risks, if there was transparency, we would probably have had more efficient markets, which probably would not have funded those riskiest of loans.
Robert Shiller, I mean, I can see responsibility on many fronts, no question about it here. And yet, you know, we don't want to see our citizenry as sort of sheep to be shorn. You know, there was a push to boost home ownership, but that can turn into kind of herding people someplace they ought not be. It occurs to me also, I mean, politicians take credit when the home ownership rate goes up. They're happy to see that. And I wonder even if this kind of really cheap credit that defied gravity, was also a way of kind of calming that middle class and lower middle class of America that wasn't seeing income gains, but instead there was a lot of money being lent to them.
Well, I think boosting home ownership does have some attractiveness, that homeowners tend to be better citizens, they tend to be more connected to their community.
On
the other hand, if they have equity, then they have a feeling of responsibility for their community because they own part of it. That's the ownership society that George Bush used in the last election, and I think he was convincing at times about that.
Sure.
But the problem is there are limits to all of this. And, you know, there is an argument for renting as well. Many people are not ready to take on the responsibilities of buying a home, maintaining it, and paying mortgage payments. And we shouldn't be pressuring people in or encouraging people falsely to go into that, because home ownership is a big responsibility. And so maybe we've reached a limit. Maybe we don't want to increase home ownership anymore.
Is there an income inequality piece to this story, that Americans trying to sort of keep up with the American dream had to stretch so far into kind of crazy loans to do it, Robert Shiller?
That's a very good point. This is an even bigger story. What is the biggest economic issue facing the country? I think it's the rising inequality. And associated with that, there is a change in our views of ourselves. I think that we're evolving into a society where there isn't the same sympathy with the working class. There's a feeling that society is divided into winners and losers, and you'd better be a winner. And so people are desperately trying to make it to the top element of our society. They're trying to fake it. One reason they buy homes that are bigger than they need is because they want to keep up the appearances desperately. And when they get foreclosed and thrown out, it is a tremendous crush to their ego. We have to get back to appreciating people for what they are and not what kind of home they live in.
But we're in the whirlwind right now. Let's go to Bruce in Boston. Hi, Bruce. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm okay.
Look, I run an organization called the Neighbor Assistance Corporation of America, NACA, and we are a subprime lender, and we provide no down payment and no closing costs, and the rate that we charge is a 5.25% today.
So are you the boogeyman here?
No, what it is, it says you can do subprime lending correctly. If you were to counsel people, you were to make sure that they can afford it, and you did it at a fair interest rate, which is a fixed rate of 5.25%. It's always a point below market, and we're able to refinance. But this conversation is frustrating because what's happening is we're blaming the victims.
Who's the victim?
It's the homeowners who are the victims, and we can no longer have this idiot defense that these investment bankers knew exactly what they were doing out there, Tom.
You're saying they did know what they were doing?
They knew what they were doing. If you looked at that, it was going to crash. They were betting on the fact that these homes were going to appreciate, and it's going to appreciate forever. Because when you look at this, this is the tip of the iceberg now, what you're seeing, because you're not seeing the resets kicking in now.
What does that mean, Bruce?
Well, you see now, and there's millions of them out there, where people have a teaser rate that's around 5 and 6%, and in 2 years after that loan is going to reset to 10 and 12%. That hasn't even kicked in yet.
So Bruce, you're saying it can be done right, but it wasn't done right clearly in the majority of cases here. And whose fault is that?
It's the investors. It's the investors. We cannot get in this attitude. We're blaming the victims because these are broker-originated loans. 70% of all the loans out there are broker-originated.
That means kind of independent brokers out there to make the sale of this loan however they can.
But, Tom, the point, and it's a really important point, the engine that drives all this is called yield spread premiums, where the brokers get a kickback for getting people into a higher rate, unaffordable mortgage, and they walk away with huge amounts of money. That's the engine. Yield spread premiums are what drives this market, and we're not even discussing it. So let's stop blaming the victims, because when those brokers give someone a loan, they say, oh, don't worry, we know you can't afford that one at 12%. You can refinance out there. And we're refinancing thousands of people.
But believe me, we're not stacking all this on Lisa's shoulders. No question, but you're in the midst of it. I'm glad to hear from you. Let's go to Deerfield Beach, Florida. Frank, what do you know?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I am a real estate agent in South Florida, and South Florida is probably the most aggressive part of the country as far as what was happening with the market.
Been a wild market down there, way up, yeah, and then down. So what have you seen, Frank?
My basic opinion of what happened is strictly greed, and I think it's greed on everybody's hands. The buyers, the lenders. You know what was happening down here is the people were having $500,000 homes, and all of a sudden their homes were $1 million. And now what they were doing instead, they were taking out that money and they were buying Ferraris.
Yeah.
So your neighbor is driving a Ferrari on money that he doesn't actually have. And then you want a Ferrari or you want a Mercedes-Benz. And basically, that is the cycle of what's happening. And then we forget that the people who are running these mortgage companies and banks are people. And they're in the same situation that the everyday person is, the average person is. And they feel the same greed. So they come up with these schemes, in essence, and that's what they are, to bring more business in.
And pretty soon they've got their Ferrari, too, until they don't. Frank, thanks for that from South Florida. Josh Rosner, I can see everybody's got a piece in this. But on the other hand, if we're looking forward here, I mean, if everybody's to blame, then nobody's to blame in a way.
Well, no, I don't. I actually think there's a couple of interesting points that were made. And I think one of the things that needs to be remembered is this is not like prior housing cycles. And it's not like prior housing cycles because, 20, 30 years ago, if you were to take out a mortgage, it was generally originated by a local lender. And unless it conformed to Fannie, Freddie, or FHA standards, the bank ended up having to hold it. Well, today, the bank doesn't hold it.
If you couldn't pay, it was on them. They had to deal with it. And they had to look you in the eye when they foreclosed.
Exactly. And they had to be probably much more rigorous in their underwriting of it. Because they knew
checking
that at the end
out.
Of the
yep.
day, they held the risk.
So now it's all way up
it's
in the top tiers of Wall Street. But what do we do about that?
Exactly. Well, I think that this is, sort of a normal cycle, unfortunately, and it's going to cause a lot of pain. And what do we do about it, I think, is actually not necessarily rush for new regulations. And the reason I say that is I think there needs to be new regulations in terms of education of borrowers, in terms of disclosures to investors in these assets. I don't know if regulation of a bailout is really going to do anything other than actually roll the loans forward. You mentioned the S&L crisis.
Yep.
A few minutes ago.
Mm-hmm.
And, one of the features was that we took bad assets and we just kept rolling them forward. There's a lot of people who actually haven't been able to buy homes. Maybe they've been saving up for the down payment. They didn't want to take the risks. And natural equilibrium, if we have foreclosures, those properties end up prices reset.
So
affordability
prices
actually
come
comes
down.
Back.
It may come
line.
Back. I want to get Robert Schiller. We've just got half a minute here. You called the 2000 bubble bursting. That hurt a lot. Before this is over, worse?
Well, I can't forecast with any certainty, but I think that there is a scenario of possibly substantially declining housing prices for some years. Between 1989 and 1994, In our major cities, home prices fell 8%. I think they might fall more than that. It's a possibility this time.
Well, wow. That's
over years.
That's a rough horizon, and we're just starting into it. We understand it a lot better thanks to each of you. Robert Shiller, author of Irrational Exuberance and the New Financial Order at Yale, thanks very much for being with us.
Pleasure.
And Josh Rosner, Managing Director at Graham Fisher & Company in New York. Mr. Rosner, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.